Welcome to the Finding Equilibrium podcast, where we dig deep into the battle of the sexes. Because let's be real, the relationship between men and women is complex, nuanced, and often fraught with tension. Women are expected to be assertive and career-driven, while men are encouraged to embrace their emotions and be more vulnerable. But are we really finding balance and harmony, or are we just creating more confusion? We know that finding true equilibrium requires us to confront the uncomfortable truths and challenge the status quo. So we're showing up to call out the cultural narratives that have shaped our perceptions of masculinity and femininity and examine how we can break free from the constraints of societal expectations and ideations, like why women are pushed to act more like men and why men are becoming more like the women they were raised to protect. So whether you're here to explore this seemingly never-ending battle or simply seeking inspiration to bring your own assets to the table, we invite you to join us for some thrilling and controversial conversation. All right, Chad, what do we got for him today?
I don't like my name. So if anybody wondering why,
Chad, it is your name.
Why that was funny. So today we're talking about pair bonding, which is kind of a new, well, not really a new topic, but it's pretty new to the social world. And I'm starting to see it all over the place. So I figured it was time to really figure out what it was all about.
Because, okay, so because this is new to me too. Like, this is something that I wasn't really familiar with either. Where are you seeing it? And in what context?
Well, I first got brought into it just from all the red pill community stuff, because a lot of the things that I watch and a lot of the podcasts and stuff that I follow talk about women's ability to pair bond after having numerous partners. So I had never even heard the term before. And since I grew up in psychology, I figured that was strange. But really, all it refers to is when two animals have a long-term attachment.
So this isn't something that we're seeing in society where we're talking about like a high body count and women are just out there just, you know, sleeping around doing the thing. This is something that only happens typically in a committed relationship, right?
No.
Okay. Well, it says the formation of a long-term committed relationship between individuals.
See, and that's the problem is that, which this is kind of jumping right into it, but
That's my style.
I was going to say, I suppose it's as good a place as any. No, and that's the problem is there is no such thing as hookup. Like there is no, here's a good way to look at it. So let's say you really like somebody and you finally get a chance to be alone and it starts getting physical and you guys start making out and all of a sudden you're overwhelmed with a feeling of like not disgust, but you know, you're very obviously not into it, not interested. Like this person that you seemingly were super into, your body is letting you know that you very obviously aren't. The problem with pair bonding is it oftentimes works just the opposite. So when and to be honest, I'm going to flip ahead here even because this kind of blew my mind. But they did a study. They were doing a study on hookup culture. And when they did a bunch of interviewing on people that were not so much monogamous, they said that 50% of the people admitted that the reason that they were part of hookup culture is because they were hoping that it would lead to a relationship. Not because it was just not for the one night stand, but you know, in hopes that it would become more. And turns out that 33% of the time, hookup culture actually does lead to a relationship. So that right there really highlights what sex can do when it comes to putting two similar people in the room together, and you can end up walking away with that pair bond, with that connection. The long-term effect is a good way to categorize it, but we just got to realize that it's not necessarily long-term. So you can create an attachment that would be a long-term attachment and then turn around and shatter it the next day. And that's, we're going to come back around to that, but that's the big issue we're seeing, is that because pair bonding is such an easy thing to create, even on accident, by the time we're ready to settle down and intentionally pair bond, some of us have significantly reduced our ability to experience the effects of pair bonding. That makes sense. It will, anyway.
Yeah. So out of the 33%, I'm just curious, and I'm not saying that you have the answers to this or not, but out of that 33%, what are the other factors that are there? You know, like, is it just because of pair bonding, or are there other things that are creating that commitment?
Most of the things that I would assume that you're alluding to will fall under typical requirements of a pair bond. So one of the crazy things about pair bonding is if you take it all the way back to, because for the most part, pair bonding is going to almost always include sex. And that's why my example was how you can think that you have this great bond with somebody, and then you, physical contact happens. And there's a lot of psychology that I'm not prepared to explain, but with sharing saliva and physical touch and smell, and like our immune systems, they actually kind of decode each other, and our bodies know each other a lot more than we think we do. And that's why sometimes we struggle to make it with somebody that we really like. And then other times we have no idea why we're so into the people we're into. But the point I was trying to make is that a lot of times pair bonding just can happen from similarities in people, obviously, but a lot of times just similarities in environment, being around somebody on a regular basis that is similar to you will consistently reconstitute. I can't think of the word. That's not the word, but yeah, like somebody that is seemingly kind of congruent with you over time will very increasingly become somebody that you see as being very, what's the word I'm looking for? When two people are compatible. Yeah. So like a lot of times compatibility doesn't seem like it's there. And that's because one of the main things that we do as people, and I didn't really realize this until I started to do a little research on this, but we're disqualifiers. That's what we do. You and I have been talking about this a lot. And this is definitely how I function. You know, like when I'm meeting women and talking to women, I don't necessarily look at the qualifiers, I look at the disqualifiers. So if there's a couple of things that are like super important to me and they automatically disqualify something, somebody, then I don't even really give them the time of day or my energy. But my body and my mind doesn't work that way. So if I'm constantly around that person, even though they might not have been able to pass my two main qualifiers, my body and my mind is realizing that there's like a whole bunch of other qualifiers that I'm ignoring that might be, you know, they're not my prerequisites, but they're going to overwhelm my ability to focus on those prerequisites. And a lot of times we end up with people that, you know, on paper, you never would have picked, you know, on Tinder, you never would have swiped on, like, but in the situation, you know, they ended up being funny or just smelling a certain way. Like there's a lot of things that, like, I tell you the craziest thing that I've found from doing research on this subject was that love is some shit that we don't know fuck about. Like the brain, the parts of the brain that activate when we are in love, and when we feel pair bonding, not just in love, but when we feel pair bonding, like, because we constantly talk about how, you know, this situation will release certain endorphins, and, you know, like we get oxytocin from this, and we get dopamine from that, and we get these different things, but we don't understand enough about our own biology and body chemistry to understand that just because this sets off a certain drug in our brain, and then this over here sets off the same drug, our brain knows that those aren't, those are different things. Like our brain is sending the oxytocin to a different place, the dopamine to a different place. So when they do brain scans on people that are like madly in love, even ones that have been in love for, you know, decades, they all have very similar brain patterns. And a lot of it is brain function in areas that we don't see brain function from anywhere else. We see the brain creating synapses connections to places that are so Cro-Magnon, so primordial, like parts of the brain that we, you know, we do this thing where we assume certain parts of our body like aren't even relevant anymore because we don't get it how they work, or we don't see them work, or, you know, and this is definitely some of that stuff. And I think that there's a lot more to pair bonding psychologically than we realize when it comes to smell and, you know, the taste of someone else, and just like I was saying, things like your immune system and stuff. But the big one that I got from my reading was that sex is huge. And it's funny because for guys, you know, we always call it, guys call it post-nut syndrome. And when you look that up, it the definition isn't great, but what it really means is that after sex, we're much more clarity on how we feel. Like we'll think we really like a girl, realize that, you know, the next morning we want contact with the person. But men and women are really different when it comes to their emotions and it comes to sex, which is why, you know, when a woman cheats, the guy wants to know, did you have sex with him? And when a man cheats, the girl wants to know, do you love her? Like there's two way different things going on. Like the easiest way for me to put it into words was that women become emotional from sex. Sex can create emotion in a female. Men are emotional about sex. So those are wildly different things, even though they kind of seem the same. And this is the number one starkest difference between the genders here, is that the boys, we don't necessarily feel, which this is crazy because we get most of our emotional adjustments and attachments and whatever from sex, but we tend to not have these crazy emotional memories and attachments to the actual acts of sex. And the reason that this is so prominent is because if a woman orgasms during sex, especially in a hookup scenario, then it's very likely that she's going to create some amount of pair bond right then and there. So I'm getting too deep.
I don't think so.
I'm getting too deep right off the bat.
What does that really mean though? You know,
attachment.
Attachment. But I think it all boils down to foundationally in everything else that you're talking about really just stems from our biology and our hormones, because all of these hormones are released from our hypothalamus, which is where like our mood, our emotion, our sex drive and attachment comes from. And it's just the release of that, which pheromones play a huge role in that as well. Like it's all our biology. So it's just subconscious connection based on the way that our body reacts to those situations. It's not like you said, you have these criteria, but your body says, well, wait, like there's something about this person. I can't put my finger on it. Maybe it is that she's funny, but maybe there's like something related to the scent or the way that she touches you or something along those lines that stimulates those hormones that is creating that bond versus like the more obvious things that we talk about. I really do think that it's an innate thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm super science all the time. So I've always wondered if our body somehow knows DNA to some degree, you know, where there's like certain factors that show up in the pheromones and stuff that, you know, let you know if you're genetically a good match. Cause I've always wondered, there's so much incest in history. When you look at so many of the cultures, And it just makes me wonder if there's stuff in us that's supposed to help us, or that does help us, to not make decisions like that, you know, like to know somebody has your DNA without you actually be, you know, something like that, where it's like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like your body just knows.
Like a protective mechanism against our evolution, kind of a thing.
Right, right. Like, I know you don't know this is your sister, but this is your sister. So yeah, the main thing that we talk about this for is, you know, well, I guess before we get to that, let's talk about what's really important here. Is pair bonding is what it really is, what pair bonding really is at a scientific level. Your brain is going to constantly wire itself to whatever your environment is. So if you have a person that you are similar with, are enjoying, that all the basic biological factors are there, you know, you guys are compatible at a biological level, your brain will start to make new connections, new synapses connections. And it's basically going to connect oxytocin receptors to good memories, is like the easiest way to look at it. So like, you are going to start to need the person around and want the person around because you feel good when you talk to that person. You feel good when you think about that person. You feel good because you're going to start associating that person with all kinds of good memories. And then the more good memories that you have, the more it's going to compound, and that person's going to get to a point to where they can do no, you know what I mean? It's like, you've created all this emotional worth because they literally, you know, are a drug, you know,
they're existence. Stimulating the hormones that certain drugs do.
Right. Right. And your brain is going to want to, you know, keep recreating those memories, you know, and this is one of the biggest things that I got from it is, so what's a good way to word this? Like, basically, especially if a woman isn't like extremely traditional in her mindset, then when the oxytocin disappears, it tends to have a really damaging effect on the relationship. Now, this isn't necessarily to say that we're destroying those connections or we're rewiring those connections. They're still there, but let's just keep it simple and say the sex hasn't been as good for a while, or maybe it's stale, or it's the same, or whatever the situation is. The bedroom's not popping off the way it used to. The female is going to experience a huge drop in the amount of oxytocin that she's used to in a day, a week, a month, and it's going to have a huge negative effect on the relationship. You don't see this as much with guys, but with relationships, it is so important to make sure that you are growing sexually and like doing a good job at being compatible when it comes to being intimate. And, you know, like, you can't be with somebody for 2 decades and not really know what trips their trigger. Like, there's no way that relationship's going to work. And so much of this literature came back to that. I mean, one of the main functions of pair bonding, like the you know, because like, why do we want a pair bond? Why don't we want to just have sex with a new person every day and have, you know, kids all over that have different parents and whatever? And it's because, well, at least men, I can't speak for women, but men need sexual access. Like, we need exclusivity so that, you know, there's just, and for the women do too, but obviously it's a little more prominent with men. But, you know, it becomes a thing where it's like your whole life is trying to find sex. So when you've successfully pair bonded, you now have sexual access and you have intimacy in your life and you have sexual excitement. And this is like the basis of pair bonding. And usually I think it's happening by accident more than anything, like I said, because we just we create sexual attachment, and from that you just end up with like romantic love and emotional attachment, and then all of a sudden, you know. But in today's culture, it's not abnormal to just end that relationship because you're young and you want to explore. So the big question is, how much damage does that do?
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of people in today's society, especially females, are embracing the polyamory and, you know, not being monogamous. And I don't know, because I can't speak from them to say what those connections look like and the commitments with their partners. But typically the reason why this happens biologically is like what we talked about with monogamy, and the reason that, you know, we biologically and hormonally are monogamous is for family and for nurturing our offspring and raising our family and, you know, carrying on our legacy. But in modern society, that's really not the goal for most people, you know, especially in this hookup culture. They're typically, you're not seeing that. So
can I stop you real quick?
Yeah.
Is legacy a thing for females? Do women think that way? I know they kind of do, because they obviously pick men for their genetics. So I know that like there's a procreation strategy right off the bat where they're definitely, you know, striving for the best genes that they can find. But I've just never like heard of a woman really talk about legacy. And then when you said that we don't really do that anymore, I feel like most men still are.
I was speaking from a female's perspective, though, and saying that the way the hookup culture is with females nowadays, that like the reason why we have these hormones and we pair bond in those commitments is because of the underlying fact that we are supposed to be the nurturer. We're supposed to be in our feminine. We're supposed to be, you know, with that person. But when you are connecting with so many people, like, can you really pair bond, or is it just like this short term? You know, that's what's hard for me, is when the definition said long-term commitment, what does that look like in hookup culture when you go back to the way that we are wired biologically, you know? And to answer your question about, do women really think that way? I see it as, it's an important thing for my male partner. Like, and I recognize that. And so I value that because I know that that is an important thing. And also, yeah, I want my kids to outlive me and to procreate and, you know, continue on our lineage. I think that's really important. And I think that in culture, we don't really value where we came from anymore. You know, that's something that I've always really been interested in, because that's like who I am, where I came from. I want to know more about that, because I live in this modern day society where we're all the same. We're supposed to be all the same. And, yeah. So that, I mean, I guess that answers your question, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it always brings me back to that. I've always wondered if that's the big difference, is women look at their offspring and they say, I want you to be happy. I want you to be whole. I want you to be content. And then a man looks at his offspring and says, you know, I want you to create. I want you to, you know, you're my mark, leave a mark that leaves a mark that leaves a mark that leaves a mark. Like, I feel such an obligation to existence just from the, like, when you think about how many dads, you know, because like I'm a boy, so I have a last name that was my dad's, that was his dad's, that was his dad's, and it could have, you know, obviously got fucked up along the line. Who knows what's
way short.
Right, yeah. But for me, it's like the fact that I even exist mean that so many people didn't die on the battlefield. You know, so many people managed to survive the famines and the fucking disease and the wars, and for fucking me to have this name still, you know, to be like, when people are talking about suicide, that always just like fucks my head up, because it's like, you don't have any right. Like, and I can't speak for anybody else. You know, life can be fucking atrocious, but like, you know, I mean, just what it took my parents for me to be here. And then, you know, if you really want to go into their parents' parents, like, it just makes me feel like a fucking asshole for, you know, and then that's how I want to raise my children, to, you know, to be the same way. You know, it's like, to have honor and to be, you know, I don't know. You just, when you speak of it, you can hear the difference between, I'm trying to create something that will create something. So
I'm a big believer in survival of the fittest. And I think, I mean, just like based on my own genetics, I have very, very strong genetics. So I feel like I should be part of the population that continues to create that, because we don't want weak people. We don't want people with diseases that can't survive. And right. Like, that's how I look at it. So I don't know.
I can get off
on a tangent about all the people that shouldn't be procreating, but I don't really want to go there.
You want to know what's so fucked up? So this is what psychology says. The more intelligent you are, the more apprehensive you are at procreation.
Mm-hmm.
So you tend to wait until you're financially sound, you're financially stable. You know, there's oftentimes it's more than just finances. A lot of times it's security and environment and blah, blah, blah. Well, women are only fertile until, you know, a certain age. And then on top of that, what ends up happening even worse is that they procrastinate to the point to where it's too late, where it's like, you know, next year and 3 years and 5 years. And then all of a sudden they realize that they're, yeah. So the opposite is the lower IQ family. They tend to not have a problem procreating. They tend to have 4 or 5 children. So the big issue there is that your low IQ genetics tend to pump out considerably more people than your high IQ genetics. And quick hot take real quick, for the most part, science says, and I say that because you can argue with this all you want and do all the research you want, but unfortunately, what the research says is that your IQ is something that is static. You're pretty much born with it, or at least it is inherent when you are, for the most part, and no amount of education or training or, you know, fucking brain IQ app on your phone or whatever the fuck it is going to change your IQ. So that means that your intelligence, not your knowledge base or your ability to retain knowledge or find knowledge or have all the answers, but your ability to use information is actually something that's biological. So the fact that low IQ families are pumping out kids at a considerably higher percentage rate than high IQ families is fucking horrifying, because that is basically what evolution is. Evolution is, you know, whatever piece of the species is most likely to get to procreate. You know, like, evolution's a weird thing. Like, the girls with the big titties having 4 or 5 kids before they're 25, because, you know, they spend their whole life dodging penis, means that you're going to start kicking out women that, you know, are more well endowed. Like, that's how crazy evolution is. It has nothing to do with what the right thing is, and everything to do with one small mutation or big mutation that tends to cause itself to become the more dominant procreator. Like polar bears are just grizzly bears with fucking albinism, but in the environment that they're in, obviously they're going to be the more dominant hunter. They're going to be the ones to procreate. They're like panthers, albinoism. They're just leopards. Like, evolution's a fucking weird thing. And we just sit here and get way turned.
Who can adapt the best, though?
Yeah, but sometimes no. That's the weird thing is, like, usually that's the case. You know, like, one organism's more susceptible to UV light, you know, but... Or no, like an organism, let's say an organism can't be exposed to too much UV light or they die. It dies. And then all of a sudden that organism, one of them has a little mutation to where it's sensitive to the UV light. So it knows better than to go to the surface of the water until nighttime. Well, obviously that one's going to be exactly what you just said. But then every once in a while, there's, you know, things that don't make as much sense, but I guess they still kind of fall along with what you just said, you know, because really, like, the environment was always the big strong protector guy, you know, so he was the one who got to procreate. Now he probably still is the one procreating. I guess you're just dating the rich guy thinking that he thinks it's your kid, but you get what I'm saying. Like, now we're looking for different things, you know, but when you say them out loud, you realize that, you know.
Yeah, I wonder about, like I said, the whole dating scene that is, you know, what we see all the time, what we talk about is, you know, that really has such a huge part in pair bonding. Can it really affect women's ability to then pair bond if they find somebody at some point in their life that they do settle down with and are in a longer committed relationship? If they've had a 300 body count with, you know, none of the guys really were anything, even though they probably had some underlying chemistry and connection and stuff that they weren't aware of, but it was just like, they didn't have the time, you know, because pair bonding also not only is biological, but there's the compatibility. And again, if it's short-term, that's going to be mostly biological because you're not really going to get to know the person enough to know what values and shit that they have or what they're interested in. There's probably not a whole lot of emotion going on there, you know, other than being naked in front of each other. There's probably not a whole lot of vulnerability. It seems like there's so many other factors that come into what pair bonding is that it would seem as if it would be a more committed long-term thing.
Right. So I see what you're saying. The way I think I started to say this and then I sidetracked myself or something, but so what science says about pair bonding is kind of the same thing it says about broken pair bonds. So there's a couple of different things going on. First of all, the basics of pair bonding can be created in a very short amount of time. It's not nearly as common. Well, the basics of it are. Like, it is definitely common for the basics of pair bonding to happen fairly fast.
Biological factors.
Huh?
Which would probably be those biological factors.
Usually, for the most part, those are biological factors, especially the whole love at first sight thing. I think it was a poet that first spoke of love at first sight, and I'm pretty sure he was actually talking about two ducks and not about people. But it really brings into perspective, like, what it means, love at first sight. So the whole point, though, with the pair bonding is what you're doing is you're creating positive connections for good hormones to flow to. So by having the pair bonder, you have somebody that you can look to that's going to give you these drugs. And then the more memories and the more time and similarities, that's where it comes back to, like, your environment. If that person is if you already have a small pair bond with that person and then you're constantly in the environment with that person, it's going to build the pair bond on its own. As long as the environment is constantly reinforcing the positive relationship and the positive memories, you're going to keep creating new neural synaptic connections that are going to make it more and more of an intense pair bond.
Can I stop you right there?
Yeah.
So the older that we get, the longer it takes to build those synapses. So do you think that, you know, we talk about women in their 40s, finally deciding that they want to settle down. Could that be a factor then as to why it's more difficult to pair bond with people, not just because of like body count, but because of age and our brain?
I would say no. I would say it would actually be the opposite. So some of this comes from your genetic biology. So predisposed.
Yep.
Some of it comes from your biology of your environment. And what I mean by that is to say that your biology is influenced by your environment and your situation in the way that we just talked about. So we just talked about how the situation is creating new connections in your brain that are releasing positive chemicals, dopamine and oxytocin, especially on a regular basis. And it's going to keep reaffirming that kind of situation. So what that does long-term for your brain, and I'm not talking about that relationship, I mean, just as a human that exists, you've now wired your brain for monogamy. You've created this mental mapping system for long-term relationships, and your brain is going to automatically associate a lot of the different things with the time. And two things are going to come from this. So one, remember that we don't know a whole lot about this other than once we start to get into this area, which now we're on to like love. Now, this isn't just a basic pair bond. We actually are in love with this person, which is just pair bonding at its most, you know, now there's a sexual and intimate attachment to take your pair bonding, which is still just a pair bond, but you know, now we're going to call it in love. This affects parts of the brain and maps parts of the brain that we don't know shit about. The big negative here is that you literally can do the opposite. So if every time your body and your mind makes a micro pair bond and you never see that person again, you're going to wire your system that way. And it's going to do two things. One, obviously, it's going to, you know, like I said, wire you to be adjusted to short-term relationships and to expect short-term relationships, want short-term relationships. Like that's going to be the system of it, but you're never going to create that long-term mapping system. And what happens over time when you get older is you're going to diminish your ability to receive the oxytocin. So even if you can create the oxytocin, there's like nowhere for it to go. And what the science that I've been reading says is that when you've done enough of damaging your pair bonds, you become extremely resistant to anything long-term, not resistant to, you know, wanting love or attention or affection or intimacy. You still want all these things, but you don't necessarily gain that rush of endorphins and whatnot from anything more than the basic interaction. And you get stuck where you constantly need something new. So you try your hardest to settle down, and then, you know, it lasts for months or maybe years. And I've read so many articles of people that have been together for just crazy amounts of time and been like, you know, that one guy, it was, you know, if I had never met Joe, then my marriage to fucking Tom would have been fantastic. But I'm always going to love him in a way that, or I'm always going to think of him in a sexual way, or I'm always going to see him as the most my most admired man that's ever been in my life. And that's one of the things that you really see, where we don't see those things with the men. We don't see those things with, not to say that, let me not mistake myself. Men have pair bonding issues too. They're just different. So women will damage their pair bond by having prior pair bonds and by having short pair bonds. But men and women's most damaging thing that they can do to pair bonds, and this is the big issue with dating in your older times, I can't what to call it when you're my age, when you're fucking old. But we've all had really damaging pair bond. I can't think of the word, but basically, you know, broken pair bonds, where the stronger the bond that was broken, the more damage it's going to, because remember I was talking about that mapping system is coded for good memories. So if you start littering that mapping system with bad memories, a failed marriage is going to be so detrimental to your ability to pair bond in the future compared to losing a 2 or 3 week relationship that you were pretty invested in. Like, that's going to have negative effects too. If you constantly have bad luck in love, then you're progressively going to have more and more negative effects to your psychological, emotional love state. If that's, I don't know how else to say it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And I'm sure there's so many other factors that play into that as well, but I love science, and the brain is one of the things that has always fascinated me, and we don't know enough about it. And so not only do we have those chemical changes in hormones, we have the structural changes, like I was saying about the synapses, and then we have the cognitive changes, where I was just looking this up because, you know, like short-term memory as we get older, and memory has a big impact on forming those pair bonds. It's like you said, the more that we can create those positive memories, the better that we're able to pair bond. And I don't know where the age cutoff is for this. I'm just like looking at the research, and it's just really got me thinking about how our brain in so many different ways really plays into that in the stages in our life. Because if you think about the way our hormones change as we age, and then you have kids, that changes things drastically for women. You know, I can't, again, speak on what it's like for men, but I'm just thinking, like, as a woman who has gone through, you know, 36, I think, years of my life, what that has looked like. And then as you get older and your brain changes so much, how does that really affect it when you are trying to form those relationships later in life versus, you know, it's like what you say about women on birth control. That's strictly hormonal.
Right.
You know, and how most women are on birth control when they're younger. You know, women in their 40s and 50s.
During mating selection.
Right. But, you know, like how, I don't know. I don't have an answer. I'm thinking out loud because I just had my wheels are turning when I was listening to you, and I was really thinking, and I'm like, all right, well, what part of the brain is really affected? And interestingly enough, it's not the hypothalamus. It's more of the structures that are related to memory and things like that. But we were talking about memory and how it connects with our ability to form those pair bonds. Our brain in general, how it changes as we age with not just hormones, but with the structure, and our cognitive abilities change, and the way that we connect memory, and just there's so many factors there that is it one thing? Is it hormones, or is there so many other factors along with it, especially as we age? Because I was comparing it to younger women on synthetic hormones and what that does to your brain and how that affects pair bonding. Naturally, we're having those ebbs and flows in our hormones and our structures of our brain. And so could we not have similar effects with how we pair bond with people?
Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Because I was talking just recently about how I've read a bunch of literature that talks about how men testosterone count drops after the wife becomes pregnant, because it's assumably, the psychology sees it as, it's the biological response to community, basically, like the you know, we're wired to sow our seed as much as possible, but then once there's kids on the way, the testosterone is the main thing that makes us do that. So the testosterone drop keeps us family oriented. But the thing that I've always wondered about is what effects is the fact that men are so, like, supposedly science says that men's sexual years, as far as their libido is concerned, mm-hmm. is like, we'll just say 18 to 35. I don't really know what the fuck it is, but I know it's like 18 to 35. And then they say that women's spike in libido is from like 35 to 50 or some shit like that. And that's a perfect example of what you're just saying. If there's any truth to that, then that just seems like it's, you know, counterintuitive as fuck to a long-term pair bonding strategy.
Yeah.
Like we don't even line up. Cause I think what I've always seen is like women want older guys and then they want younger guys. So women always want the same age of guys. But do you think
for the most part that these major pair bonds are happening in that window of time for both men and women? Because there is some overlap. And
you mean early?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. That was in a lot of the research that I was reading really made me wonder if the same kind of pair bond can truly be created at 35 as at 18. And it really doesn't seem like it. Like there's so much compounded information for both sexes. So for the most part, psychology tends to look at us getting experience as a negative, especially women. So even people that are educating this literature are quick to say, we should go out and sow our oats and be curious. And, you know, that way we end up with the right type of person. That way we can see what's out there and different stuff. And, you know, I hear that all over the place, but when you read the literature, it completely disagrees. Like it really disagrees. And the thing that I really seem to get from it is that a strong pair bond as a youth with traditional values is you're getting to start that mapping system at 20 years old, at 18 years old. So by the time you're 40, you've had 20 years to create this system of love and monogamy in your mind, and your brain is automatically going to, like, basically at the very most simple perspective, you're going to think of love and monogamy fondly. Those two things are going to go together in your mind, and it's going to be so much bigger than that. And it just doesn't seem like you can create those things. I have a question that I've always wondered this. Let's take a completely hypothetical situation, and let's take a female that isn't inherently damaged. So let's say that she's got a good family structure and basic traditional values, just a normal person, right? And by not damaged, I just mean the dad was around.
Abused, neglected, or...
Right, exactly. Yeah. So knows what to expect, you know, it, that's not the right word, but like expects the right things from the environment and from men and stuff. Doesn't worry that all men are going to do all the wrong things. So you got this seemingly normal woman. My question is, let's say that woman's been with 15 people. And let's say it's not because that woman's promiscuous. Let's just say she's had really bad luck in relationships, like making decent decisions, but just happens to be getting with guys that are, you know, stuff is happening, whatever. We don't need to come up with all kinds of fucking scenarios, but you get what I'm saying. You know, been with 15 different men, not because of hookup culture. My question is, even if one of those men was rich and one of those men was well endowed and one of those men was, you know, intelligent, and one was endearing and one she really admired and adored, and one of them really tripped her trigger, if she meets a man that is to her seen as a higher value in all of those departments as all of those men, as long as she hasn't done serious pair bonding damage because of just starting to associate relationships poorly because they always end for her, can she have a perfectly happy life being madly in love with this man, never comparing him to anybody else because of what he is? Let me just cut to the fucking shit. Can you become a man that could take a promiscuous woman and fill in all those blanks to where her past doesn't define her future?
I thought she wasn't promiscuous.
And then I took that shit off the table and I took it to the extreme. Because nothing makes sense unless it's the fucking extreme. So let's take it to the extreme. You got a fucking woman who's got a 50 head count. And
all of those guys have different attributes, but not one of them had all of the things.
Some of them had more than one, but none of them were
right. This none of them guy. Were all of the things.
This one guy just happens to be up here. Everybody else was. So what's that look like? Can she be happy?
Is that the question?
The real question is, I'll tell you what the real fucking question is, because I talk to a lot of men and we all have the same question.
Ooh, no pressure.
All the women that we are talking to have higher body counts than what we've ever been used to. And for the most part, they all have a body count higher than what psychology recommends for a monogamous relationship. So my question is, can a man become something that he doesn't have to be so fucking worried about a woman's past? Because we live in a generation where women have a past.
What does psychology deem as normal or safe?
Oh, for a woman, less than 6. And I know that's a super generality because it could have been, you know, 6 of the fucking doofiest and goofiest. And, you know, this other girl could have been with one guy and he could have been Superman and you're never going to live up to him. So, I mean, obviously but psychology says 6. And I feel like that just sounds low. I mean, personally, 6 sounds like a lot when it's like, I would love for the woman to be like, no, I've had sex one time, but that's not the reality of it. But 6 just sounds like unrealistic in today's day and age, I guess. When it's upwards of 10, the divorce is like, I'd have to look it up because I'm trying to just remember, but it's ridiculous. The statistic is ridiculous. It's the old joke. If you jumped out of an airplane and there's only 30% chance the fucking thing was going to open, there's only 50% chance that marriage is going to work in the first place without these statistics. So it's only 50% beforehand, and then you add a 10 body count to the female. Does that, you know, are we all just doomed?
That's just body count in general. That's not like 10 guys that she was with for a while.
No, it's super. Like,
I feel like that matters.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that was my point. That's why I feel like, you know, it could be a 1 head count where it was Superman, or it could be a 10 head count where they all were, they don't compare to you at all. And it was just, it's a.
But I feel like there are so many women out there that the goal is to just sleep with the dude.
Yeah, that's a big thing now.
So
they get value. They feel not get value, but they feel value. And I like women need to understand that being able to get sex from a guy is zero worth.
My initial response to your question, but then I had to dig a little deeper to really understand and think about my responses. I don't think it's an issue for the guys. I think it comes down to the woman. Women come to the table with a lot of insecurities, and their main goal, whether it's commitment or just a one-night stand, is attention and focus on me. And until that is resolved, I can't really answer your question, because that's something that she would have to come to terms with and want to do something about. Because if you can just go out in this world where men will just grovel at your feet and give you the attention, and you can just hop from one to the other, what value is it for her to stay with somebody and put in the work if she can just get what she wants initially anyway from anybody? Because she just wants to feel good about herself.
I don't know how to answer this question, because this is the hardest. This is the number one thing that men talk about, is how to deal with the fact that today's women will not be told no. Like, if you have any kind of a backbone, then, and I'm not saying you want to be with women like this. So, I mean, it's a great screening process, but for the most part, women with options, you know, being attractive women, they want the world to be the way they want it to be. So
I believe that deep down, that's what women do want. I just think that women have a problem with the way that it is presented and said. And if you were to...
Yeah, I agree.
If you were to make it her idea, sell it to her, this is hard, because this comes down to psychology and how she would have to see a man a certain way for her to open up to that idea. And I think that comes down to that whole safety, security, I trust you, there's something about you that stands out above the rest of the people, but you still have to give me that attention and all the things, because if not, I am not going to allow you to tell me no. But if you treat me as this pet and it's me and all the things, then maybe. But if a woman can just get out of her own way about that whole attention, I got to have things just focused on me and I can go everywhere and do all the things all the time, she's comfortable admitting that it's okay for a man to be directive and assertive, because he doesn't mean ill by it. And I think society has done a really poor job of emphasizing that when a woman is told no, or, you know, that she can't do these things, that it's out of control, because I think a lot of women come from toxic relationships where they were in a controlling type of environment, where that plays into the majority of other relationships. So she walks into these relationships with the past trauma and all the bullshit that she dealt with, and she's going to put that on your relationship and you right from the beginning, regardless of who you are. And so she's coming into the relationship and she already has these preconceived ideas of who men are and how they treat her, because she's allowed that of herself. It's not a thing that the guy can really do. She's got to figure that out.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought this up, because somehow I forgot to touch base on it. When women get older, they tend to have more baggage. What you just described is literally what baggage is. And it is one of the significant differences between men and women when it comes to pair bonding when we get older. So women tend to, and I'm not saying men don't do this, but women specifically, they bring a lot of baggage into the relationship and almost expect things are going to be, you know, this is how this is. No, this is how, you know, dickhead acted. This isn't the way that everybody acts. But women tend to get kind of imprinted on, and they carry that stuff into the next relationship that might otherwise be a healthy relationship, but the broken, right? And there's more going on than just the outward obvious baggage. there's internal mapping that's been, you know, when she feels certain feelings that normally would reinforce trust and loyalty and monogamy, to her, they're connected to a different pathway and they're connected to bad memories. And it makes it much harder to pair bond. And one of the big things that this took me to is one in four children, and this, I didn't have time to like sit and really look up these stats, but let's just say a lot of children don't have a dad, or at least don't have a positive male role model. And personally, I spent a lot of time with fathers in different coaching scenarios and whatnot. And I can tell you that fathers aren't very tough and strong and backbone. And like, they're not running the household the way that, you know, their daughter's going to the dance wearing something she shouldn't be because he's too afraid to open his mouth. Like, the relationship from day one is messed up because these girls are being raised by no father, or by a father that's too afraid to be a father, or didn't have a good father of his own, or, you know, like there's baggage from day one nowadays, it seems like. So yeah, I feel like personally, that baggage from both genders is detrimental to being in your late 30s and trying to be with somebody and to relate with them. And like, trauma bonding is when one of the people in the relationship is toxic. So the term trauma bond isn't the right term, but I feel like a lot of the relationships I see at age are trauma bonds. They're not true trauma bonds where one of the people is toxic. They're trauma bonds from the sense of they have similar trauma. Like, I feel like that's where we're at nowadays, is if we are attracted to somebody in our 40s, it's somebody that's walked the fire that we've walked. Because we are our trauma and our baggage now. You know, how could I ever relate to somebody who wasn't, you know, thrown away? Or how could I ever relate to somebody who wasn't whatever the fuck my story is? So I don't,
I think that we're always just trying to be seen and understood. And so what better way? I mean, you look at people who are addicts, they hang out together because they understand each other. They have something in common.
Right.
They share the highs, no pun, and, you know, all the shit that goes along with that. And so it's just the same.
Well, and they don't judge each other over those things either.
Yeah, right. So I think that's similar to, you know, coming to a relationship with similar shit for sure. Yeah, just from my own personal experience with coaching and the women that I talk to, there are a lot of, oh man, like if I had to run the statistics, I would say damn near 100% of the women that I talk to will admittedly say that they don't feel good enough. They have self-confidence issues. They self-sabotage. They bring their own insecurities and limiting beliefs into their relationships because of past stuff, whether that's from a romantic relationship or just like trust issues in general from family or, you know, whatever life situation. And it is, I truly believe it is her own demons that stand in the way of her and that guy. And that guy, until she can stop that cycle, and she doesn't do it intentionally. That's the thing, is that most of these women are aware and logically they know that that's not okay. They don't have any clue on how to implement anything to move forward, to get over that, to stop letting it affect how they show up in a relationship, because it's not really about what the man is doing or not doing. It's about how she is seeing and valuing herself, that just spills into the relationship. And a lot of that, like the way like women lash out on men all the time and stuff, I think that's just their own insecurities and the ways that they're just trying to figure out their own shit and their emotions. And it just comes out as like, well, you're not good enough, or you're not doing these things, when really it's just like, they can't figure it out for themselves and look in the mirror and change the reflection. And until they can really do that, it's going to be really hard for anybody to break through that. That's my perspective, just based on what I hear a lot.
Yeah, that's.
And so I guess I don't have an answer to what that looks like, other than I really think that more women need to have, I don't know if support is the right word, because, and I don't necessarily believe in traditional therapy, but she has to just be open and vulnerable about it to that person and just lay it out there and be like, this isn't because of you, you know. But then women have a really hard time taking the blame for anything. Women are already insecure. They know it, but they don't really like to talk about it or point it out and be like, I am the problem. Women are horrible at I am the problem. And yeah, if we could just get over that and just be like, I am the problem. I feel like so many more women could be helped by a supportive person in a relationship if they could just be open about those kinds of things, rather than hiding it, masking it in a short skirt and, you know, promiscuity and all the other ways that we try to be comfortable. Like, women want to be comfortable. They want to be confident. And so the way that they do that is by, let me get attention. Let me dress a certain way. Let me get catcalled. Let me get all these high body counts, because that gives me value and status. That makes me feel good about myself, even though it doesn't. She feels like shit. I mean, if she has values, she probably does. You know, like that post-nut clarity, it's like, oh, I'm such a piece of shit.
That's what post-nut clarity really is, guys. If you were to look it up, it's not at all what I say it is. But I mean, it is, but the definition of it is more what Stacy just said.
There's just a lot of psychology in it's. It's deep. It's very common. It's something that I get told all the time. And it's just something that I don't know what the answer is. I see the problem. And, you know, through what I do, trying to really get them to already just acknowledge and accept what they already know about themselves. But it takes work. It's a process. Like, it hurts my head to think about all the things that you have to do that. You know, that's why I don't have an answer.
This is this is good stuff, because really, this is everything that's going on. So Jordan Peterson, I probably brought this up a billion times already, but he has a little spiel he has about how nobody taught us how to think. And there's a lot of steps to properly thinking. Like, you don't just have a thought. Like, you actually have a bunch of thoughts, and then you got to sit there and, you know, figure which of these thoughts are even viable, which even make any sense, you know. And then you weed through the thoughts, and then which thoughts do you feel wholesome about, which thoughts do you feel are your opinion, which thoughts do you like. There's so much to just having a thought. And my dad, growing up, he always used to joke about how there weren't a lot of classes about learning. They never taught you how to learn. They never taught you how to study. They never taught you how to properly take notes. I'm not saying that no teacher ever did these things, but as far as the curriculum's concerned, they've never educated us on how to educate ourselves, even from their materials. Like, we don't know what the fuck we're doing. And the sad thing about what you were just saying is that this is how life is for men and women, especially when it comes to relationships, especially when it comes to relationships for someone who maybe didn't have the best examples at home. You know, a lot of us have divorced parents, and you know, good parents, good people, you know, but they weren't able to keep it together. And, you know, maybe the man wasn't around as much because, you know, there was a stepdad, and the stepdad doesn't just typically have the impact that dad has, you know. And hearing you talk about it, it really makes me sad, because it occurs to me that, you know, because the main thing I hear you say is if people were honest with themselves, they could be honest with each other. But the reality is, people aren't educated in how they think. So people don't understand themselves. So there's nothing to be honest about, because they don't know why they are the way they are. They need what they need, or why they gravitate towards other people that are broken in the ways that they are broken. There's definitely a lot of accountability to it, for sure. But I think we struggle so much to be healthy, and all we really want is a little bit of attention. And women are able to get it, whether it's by the most moral means or not. And just saying it out loud makes me realize that if I can't get attention any other way except for a way that's promiscuous, that's probably how I'm going to get attention then. You know, if I wear a low cut blouse and a tall, you know, a high skirt, and all of a sudden I've got all these options, and wouldn't I be silly not to do that? Like, you know, I know you're telling me that the one guy I really want, he's probably not going to be as interested in me, but maybe if I can get him in bed, you know, then that's how I've done it in the past.
I think women really like comfort and familiarity. And which is part of the reason why so many women have patterns in those relationships. And it all comes back to just not seeing yourself as, like, it's this cycle of women are constantly stuck in this body, like screaming, and they can't get out. And they just, like you said, they can't understand why they get in these situations. But when you really dissect it, it just comes back to the way that they view themselves. And they don't really need that attention. It's just giving them that security. It's something familiar.
Right. It's familiar.
Something that can take their mind off of everything else that's going on. It makes them feel good. It's like a drug. They're just seeking that high. They get it. They come down. They feel like shit. They feel worse about themselves than they did the night before. They go out and they do it again. All because they want to feel that love and that acceptance and that I am good enough.
Yeah. So basically, I tell you what, I get advice for everybody right now. So coming from somebody who has had therapists, and man, I had a great psychologist growing up. Just changed my life in a minute. Just, you are not going to find that for the most part. Therapy is a dangerous thing. Psychology is as good as the psychologist. Psychiatry is there to prescribe you drugs. Mm-hmm. So if you want to be educated in yourself and be confident in yourself, right off the bat, go to the fucking gym. I swear to God, if you don't have good mental health and you want good mental health and you are not working out, I can't fucking help you. But if you want to understand yourself, find someone to talk to. And I don't mean find someone to talk to you. I mean, find someone to talk to so that you can hear your problems spoke from your mouth out loud. I promise you that you will solve the fucking mysteries of the universe if you just speak out loud.
Well, we've talked about that all the time, is a good therapist asks the right questions, because the goal is to have the person come to that conclusion on their own, because they already know, it's already there. It's just that they have to ask the right questions to get that person to think, because we don't do that. Like you said, we don't sit there and think about our stuff and think about our past and think about why we are the way that we are. But if you have somebody that you're able to bring that out of you and able to have those conversations with yourself, that person's just leading, you know, they're not talking. They're just asking a question and you just answer it for yourself. Just allow you to have that conversation out loud as if you're talking to them. But really the goal is you're just talking to yourself. The therapist is just guiding the conversation for yourself. Like, they're just there as moral support, really. They're facilitating your monologue.
I couldn't agree more. The best therapist and the best psychologist, Jordan Peterson, says all the time that, and this is what he's been doing for the past 30 fucking years or something. And he says all the time that his job is to do his best not to give advice, to basically just exactly what you just said, to be the mediary between you and your thoughts. Instead of, we've all seen it in the movies where it's like, you know, why do you think you do that, Mr. Jones? And then he's like, well, blah, blah, blah. And it's like,
there's your answer.
Right. So,
well, and think about how we are socially. And if it's your idea, it's the right idea. And so,
right.
If you are getting told something, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's just somebody's opinion and somebody's advice. I don't need to take that. But when you say it, you're like, damn, yeah, that's legit, you know? And so you're more apt to make those changes because it's coming from you, not the therapist, the professional, the one that, oh yeah, sure,
right,
you know, just go for a run. Yeah, it's that easy. You know, just leave your abusive relationship. Sure. When you say it, you know, then you're like, okay, now things start to fall into place.
Well, and that's why the answer and the question are often the same thing. You know, it's, you can tell somebody you're damaging yourself by doing this. Well, you just made me defensive. Yeah. Are you damaging yourself by doing that? Well, yeah, I guess a little bit. Yeah. It's like, it's the same fucking thing. You just needed to do it on your own instead of somebody telling you you're fucking up, because you're just going to get defensive when somebody tells you you're fucking up. So, and I've spent a lot of time in the past, all year or so, ever since I started to get into this space a little bit, and trying to be that person for other people. And man, that's the ticket right there. Like, if you're trying to help anybody in your circle, your job is just to listen, get them talking, ask the questions, and remember the old Japanese fucking whatever it's called, you know, that you don't know what's good and what's bad, you know, so careful giving advice. You'd be surprised how something that seems terrible might not be, and something that seems fantastic might just be a big lie. So your job is to just be, you know, a little bit the devil's advocate, good at asking questions, great at listening, great at being supportive, but coming from somebody who gives advice all the fucking time, man, it's a dangerous road, good or bad. It, being the one attached to advice is a struggle. Like, if you can give somebody the same advice but make them think it was their idea, just like Stacy just said, that's it right there. Because otherwise you're liable. You know, and you take it from people. That's the other thing too. Actually, I got this from something Jordan Peterson said once, was about how if you give someone advice and it works, well, then you get all the credit. And if you give someone advice and it fails, well, then you get all the credit. So even if it's the right advice, oftentimes it's not going to be the way you think it is. You know, like it's, you think you're giving the younger you advice. You're not.
Well, it just comes down to what I've always said is that you can have five people with very similar experiences and backgrounds and put them in the same environment. And every single one of them is going to have a different way that they respond to that. And so just because you had an almost identical thing happen to you, well, there's a chance you didn't respond the same way this person's responding. So you're not the same person. So, all right. What's your advice there on pair bonding as we wrap this up?
I get that one a lot though. What you just said, like you, I'm to the point now where just before I came to this podcast today, I was talking to one of my closest friends and I heard a statement that I've been hearing for the past year or so, even from my son, where one of my closest friends looked right at me and said, I can't verbatim, but something along the lines of, you know, like what you do, but you're a psychopath. And yes, I'm aware that by definition, that doesn't make any sense at all. But they don't know what the definition of psychopath is. They just think it's somebody that's out of their fucking mind. And my dad lately has been just really on me, reminding me that the lenses that I look through are not the lenses that everyone else looks through. So,
but a good teacher doesn't push their agenda onto other people. They just are. And the people respond to that.
Yeah. But the problem with being seasoned, what's the word I'm looking for? Experienced. The problem with being experienced is you are severely desensitized. So my kid asks me all the time about like other people in pain. And it's like, you know, dude stubs his toe and it's like the end of the world for that. Or he forgot, he didn't pack his lunch right. And it's like, oh my God, you know, and he's like, I don't understand. Why is it when there's people over here that are like, don't have a fucking arm and they're fine. And it's really hard to get people to understand that pain is extremely subjective. So if the worst pain you've ever experienced is your dog dying, then you're going to be fucking devastated when your dog dies. Now, if you've had multiple dogs die and your parents have died, you know, then when a dog dies, it's devastating, but it is much quieter. So when that person is speaking to the other person, it's hard because their perspectives are so fucking far away. Because to this person, you could cut their toe off and make it through the day. And then this person over here would stub their toe and get back in bed. And it makes it really hard to give advice because you give advice through the lenses of somebody who can carry more weight than the person you're talking to. And that's the thing that I forget all the time when I'm trying to speak to the younger me, as it were. That doesn't work. I can't just talk to people the way I would talk to the younger me because they're not going to be receptive of it. They're just going to be like, well, you sound like you're fucking crazy. You're right. Because I am crazy. And so is the younger me. So my advice doesn't work for you. 1,000 push-ups doesn't fix your problem. It probably would, but you get what I'm saying. Like it just.
Yeah, it's just everybody has a different level of resilience. And I think the more pain that you go through, the more resilient you are. And so you can handle that. It just builds on it because you're like, oh, that's all you got? You know, I've been through way worse. And then, like you said, you know, I can think of a lot of people in my life that haven't really had it rough at all. Never experienced not even a high level of physical pain, let alone like anything emotional. And what I've gone through would wreck somebody that has never endured pain like that.
Right.
You know? And I think it's just all about how resilient you are to that, because when you go through that, you don't have a choice but to come out of that. So
some people break.
Yeah. Yeah.
But hopefully it forges you. Hopefully. And yeah, I agree. And that's a good point, is we need to do our best to try and talk to people from where they're at as far as resilience is concerned. You know, try and remember where you were at when you were at that level of resilience. Like, there's...
That's why we don't give advice.
try not to, anyway.
We just ask the right questions. I don't know. You know, we speak from experience, and we speak from a point of just wanting to know more ourselves. And so this podcast, in a way, is like our speaking out loud so that we can understand more to help other people. So it's like, as we understand, they understand things. And yeah, because like I said, this whole topic today with pair bonding is just a newer one for me, that I have a lot more questions. But the fact that we can open people's mind to it and bring awareness to the fact that it's a thing, and what can we do? You know, I don't know. I guess it depends on what your agenda is, but hopefully, you know, the takeaway is just start bringing awareness to how what you're doing is affecting you and your relationships, like your past relationships, your future relationships. Just start thinking. Take time to ask questions. Do some research. Go to the gym. It's a good place to start. I like that.
All of those things are really good. I think, like, people do not do any emotional, psychological, or sexual education. Like, we let each other down for years and years and years because we're fucking idiots, and we just think that it's good enough because it's been good enough and it's not good enough. So, so if we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up, because this is a good example of one where, like you said, we learn that way too. So by educating ourselves and talking about it, we learn what questions we need to ask next time so that we can talk about this again down the road when we're more educated and we've got more experience and stuff. The couple of takeaways and the couple of things that we can part with, a couple of funny tidbits of information I got. There's a lot of animals that actually do mate for life. Penguins are probably the most commonly known one, but there's actually quite a few animals that mate for life. In extreme circumstances, penguins are the one to talk about, though, man. They spend a lot of time on each other, and then when they really do become a unit, they stay together forever. And oftentimes, when one of them dies, the other one will leave the little penguin kingdom, and they go off. They don't really commit suicide, but they go somewhere where they can't take care of themselves, and they end up dying. So it's
they isolate.
Yeah. Well, and the pack will way far away too, but the pack will go get them sometimes even and bring them back. And they just end up leaving again, and they go and they die.
Why do you got to end this on such a sad note? Like, I love penguins.
I think that is the fucking least sad thing I've ever heard of. Like, that is the most beautiful fucking thing. Like,
I just want to hug the penguin. I get where you're coming from. Like, yes, that's unconditional love, you know, but it's just like, aw.
It blows me away when people don't see sentience in animals. Like, it just, you know, the foxes love, like, wolves mate for life. Like, there's so much stuff out there, and even the darkest parts of biology that are so beautiful and sad. One thing I wanted to say really quick, we're talking about hookup culture. You know, women control access to sex. So if you don't want guys hooking up with you, then don't put out so easy. you know, I don't like, I'm not saying withhold sex indefinitely until marriage. It's probably not going to get you anywhere either, but like, just realize that women hold the key to sex, men hold the key to relationship. So, you know, you might get the guy in bed, but if you want him to be there in the morning, throwing your pussy at him might not be the way.
So, why is it that they are so eager to just throw it all out there in the beginning, and then when they do get married, then it's just like, well, I don't need that anymore?
Well, because they were using it.
Yeah,
they threw it out there to use it, not for their own benefit.
Because they want to feel that they're good enough. They want the attention. And then when they have it, they're like, well, I don't need that anymore. And then when they don't get it, and then the relationship goes downhill, then they seek it again because they're like, I need attention. You're not giving me attention. And then they go and run off and do it all over again.
Which is why there's a lot of bad psychology to keeping a woman around. Giving her all your attention all the time might not be the way to do it. So, but that's a whole nother conversation, because you definitely treat a woman differently. It's tough, you know, because the psychology to keeping a woman around isn't necessarily the same psychology to dealing with a woman that's truly traditional and monogamous. Most of the psychology to keeping a woman around is about tricking a woman into being monogamous. So you got to be careful, because you might be tricking a woman that's traditionally monogamous. Like, you might have found the woman that's really trying to be the one, you know? So it's really tough. We don't know what the fuck we're doing. Like, I was reading a thing today that it was talking about love, and it was just talking about how there's no equal love. There's no equal love. Like, somebody always loves the other person more, which means one person is the adored and one person is the adorer. And they're both positive and negative, because the person that's adored gets to be loved, like, just almost unconditionally, you know, but the person that's the adorer gets to have the person that they love unconditionally. So it's like, relationships are fucked up. There's so much psychology to it that we don't sit and talk about because we're fucking dumb and we just don't know any better, is most of the thing. So, but yeah, the only thing that I've got is sex, 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 god damn it, because sex, because it always comes back to sex. So guys out there, if you know, like we were talking about earlier with educating yourself, you know, understand psychology so that you can kind of understand your spouse, understand emotions and hormones, and don't be surprised every month when, you know, like, what the fuck? And sex is not something that you're just going to be inherently good at. So if women truly are affected by the memories of positive sexual experiences, and you're not reading some kind of literature that's teaching you how to be better in the bedroom, well, then what the fuck, man? Nobody told me, so I don't, you know, I can't sit here and be like, you're dumb, you know, but I feel dumb, you know, for being 40 years old and never thinking, like, you know, I always thought, I still do, you know, like, I know what the fuck, I don't need to read no fucking book, you know what the fuck. Yeah, you're fucking stupid. You're as stupid as me and all the other fucking guys. Like, you would not believe the amount of literature that I have read since I have become a single middle-aged man, talking about how, you know, like, I just was watching a thing with a porn star the other day where she was talking about how she used to think that she needed a big dick to be happy, and one of her best friends was a sex coach. And she was telling him that. She was telling him, like, you know, no, I need at least 8.5 inches and blah, blah, blah. It was a big old conversation, which, by the way, 7 to 8 inches is the agreed upon respectable size that a woman would choose if she could choose. But, and that dude, and this is just some bullshit fucking, you know, shit I was watching, but anyway, that dude, this woman that had been a porn star forever, that dude made her come with one finger in like 2 seconds and forever changed her perspective on what's important in the bedroom. And that is the reality of life. Like, you don't know what you're fucking doing any more than she knows what the fuck she's doing. And I guarantee that the more positive memories that you create of romance, intimacy, security, you know, do the things and be the things and stay on the path. And maybe it won't matter that she's been with 55 guys already.
Maybe the women could do men a solid and know what they like and communicate it. Because again, conversations that I've had, that's something that they don't talk about because I don't know why.
Well, they usually say the opposite. Most of the things that I read and watch, women literally say, this is what makes me aroused. And then when they do studies on the same women, they find out that it's completely bullshit.
Probably because they are saying that because that's what they think the guy likes.
No, they're afraid to say what the truth. Do you know what the number one most thing when they hook the women up to, I don't know how they did it, you know, but they like hooked them up to arousal sensors and stuff. What do you think the number one thing that was getting most of the women aroused was? It's going to blow your mind.
Other women.
Rape scenarios.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck are we supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
Like, and that's the thing is that's the, like,
don't tell me no, don't beat me, but.
Well, and that psychology definitely says that your strongest, most dominant boss females are the ones that want to be the most submissive in the bedroom. This is what psychology says. I'm not saying that's my own position, but that's what psychology says, is that the more dominant, the more submissive. But it's going to take, you know, some confidence to do that.
Yeah, I think it just goes back to women just don't know what the hell they want. Just attention. Right. Just give me attention.
People don't know what they want.
Yeah, but I think a lot of the confusion comes from the fact that, you know, we're trying to figure out what the guys are doing wrong or what they could be doing. And it's just the women need to, not saying that the guys don't need to do stuff too to improve, because I feel like there are a lot of fuckboys out there that just don't have a clue. But what we're talking about in forming those strong relationships and having something that's successful is really just comes back to her. What is she like? Why can't she communicate it? What is going on with her? Why does she feel like she has to have all this attention? Like, take a look in the mirror
and right,
and talk about it. Why can't you share those things that you like? I mean, men are open about that kind of stuff. Like, are you embarrassed? If you shouldn't be. It's a weird thing to be in the bedroom anyway. Why make it awkward? And it should be enjoyable. So why make it anything less than that? I don't know, more insight on yourself.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying for sure. Like, the men are over here trying to do more, but we don't even know what the fuck to do.
How about this? I used to be one of those peer romance salespeople, and I loved it because of the education and the stuff that women, grown women, like people my mom's age, would not have a clue about with their bodies at all. Like, just completely right, uneducated. And it's like, that, what? You know, the first couple of times that happened to me, I was just blown away. I'm like, what do you mean? And it was just a common thing. It was pretty consistent, which is really scary, because it's like, what are you doing at one of these parties if you just like don't even know? You know?
That's probably what they're doing. Is they're like
trying to figure it out.
Right. Like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Like, tell me what I don't know.
They said there was going to be some penis straws and booze.
Right. Yeah, that's a scary thing. That really sheds light on what I was just saying. Like, that's the whole thing, is how the fuck can women tell us what they want from us when they don't even know? You know, they don't
look in the mirror, do some reflecting.
Yeah. I agree. I wish that there was good therapy out there that I could tell people to go to, but find good friends, have good friends. That's all I can say. Almost all of my epiphanies come from just talking to you out loud. Then once I hear the words in the space, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm dumb. Been rolling around in my head for months. And then the second they hit the fucking air, I was like, I knew what to do with them.
Yep.
Such a crazy thing. So.
All right. Well, good shit.
Shit that was good.